Welcome to Saha Says, where we go over headlines of the week, sharing our in-the-weeds opinions. Joining us tonight on the program is Pinky, the team captain for UTSA's CCDC team, Cooper, a biohacker, news curator, and a podcast announcer himself, participating on additional podcasts that he might be willing to share with us. And me, I'm Sciatic Nerd. I am the B-Sides SATX coordinator and the manager of this podcast. Up first, we do want to thank our sponsor, Axion VPN, who delivers a quality solution for your private connection needs. For more information about their offerings, please check them out at axionvpn.com. And if you or your organization is interested in sponsoring the efforts of Saha or Saha Says, feel free to reach out to us on Twitter at SATXHackers or hashtag SATXHackers. Thanks much. First up in the news this week, we're going to talk about a new bank privacy tool that exposes opaque and possibly illegal sharing policies. The story comes to us from motherboard.vice.com, and it discusses the concept of what is your bank share? And with access to consumers' most revealing private information, the question from the article is, what do they do with it all? What do they do with your money? You know, and we might naively assume, according to the article, that that answer is nothing. But of course, revealing private information is about the most valued commodity in the information economy, which means that it is, of course, being bought and sold like the currency that personal data is, circa 2016. Okay, so when we think about it, any institution or organization really values our personal information because, in a way, we can be considered as products. That's how come Facebook doesn't charge us, right? MySpace would have worked the same way. Any social media venture generally would sell any information we give up to other interested parties, because I bet you there are a lot of folks who want to know what toothpaste and soap we prefer and what kind of commoditized items we like. Do we like the color green, chartreuse? What about April Flourish? I mean, really, there has to be some kind of paint color or soap, laundry soap that we prefer. And in that, that's what drives our economy. Information, right? That's what all of this is about. So, according to the article, they've collected some information. It says, we collected lists of financial institutions in the U.S. and wrote a computer program that automatically queries Google in search of companies' standardized notices on their websites. Upon finding such a notice, the program automatically parses the standardized notice and feeds the extracted information into a database, enabling a large-scale comparison of the financial institution's privacy practices. Starting from lists of financial institutions, I should stop reading that now. The point is, if you dig into it, there's a lot of different privacy policies that they're digging into. And what it turns out is that 3/4 of all banks have opted to skip the recommended form, presumably in favor of friend of online disclosures everywhere. Obscurity. Oh, there it goes. No. What it said is banks have opted to skip the recommended form, presumably in favor of the friend of online disclosures everywhere, known as obscurity. At the very least, skipping the form excludes banks from the privacy policy tool and this sort of analysis generally. It's very interesting, this Carnegie Mellon paper. It discusses how folks have no standard format for privacy policies. Or maybe I'm misreading that. All of this to say that people want to have a choice when it comes to their own personal privacy, but it gets confusing, right? So why would you choose a bank that chooses to sell your information? And the general thought is you wouldn't. I mean, Pinky, if you were choosing a financial institution, wouldn't you be concerned about what they're sharing about you, right?
I wouldn't, and that's part of the reason why I aim for a credit union rather than a bank. I find banks in general have a little bit more evil practices per se when you start reviewing them. And credit unions, I guess, you know, because everyone who's a member of the credit union actually gets a say and so on, so you can feel like you actually apparently have a say.
I like how you said feel like you have a say.
Yeah, it's tempting to make that go off track, but I'm going to try to keep us on track for once.
All right.
So the wheels aren't going to fall off today?
We'll see.
They're going to fall off in 5 minutes.
Okay.
Timer started.
Good.
But, you know, talking about privacy, it just makes you wonder then how many different banks, credit unions, and everybody else, you know, sells your information. Because even, you know, if you read the fine print, even trying to apply for a car loan And purchasing a car at a dealership means they can sell your information.
Yeah.
And they often do.
Yeah, it's really annoying. When I leased my new Corolla recently, one, they got annoyed at me because I actually read the paperwork, which they didn't appreciate.
It takes time, right? And
it takes time, and then I ask questions, and they're like, well, you're not supposed to. You're supposed to just, you know, sign off your soul without reading it.
Oh.
So, you know, pretty much. But also, there was an option where it's like, you can't say no to them selling your information, or otherwise you get disqualified from their, or you risk getting disqualified from their financing. And when you're leasing, you can't do that. You know, there's just a few places here where it says, you agree that we can do blah, 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 blah. And there was no point where you say, well, I disagree.
Right.
Because you're saying you disagree means you don't get the lease.
Yeah, you don't get the car. So, yeah, take it or leave it, buddy.
Take it or lease it. No, wait. So, Coop, then I'm going to go back and pose the same question to you. Do you have, if you do the financials for your world, do you prefer bank or credit union or, you know, maybe a jar in the backyard? I don't know. Everybody's different.
I'm definitely not a mattress or a jar in the backyard kind of guy. Yeah, because paper is paper. It'll self-destruct over time, just like this message in 30 seconds.
Nice.
Wait, what? But,
Agent 99. No, wait.
To get back to reality for a second, I know this is hard. Now, I'm definitely not going to, you know, say exactly who I bank with or credit union with, or, you know, I like money. I put it in a financial institution and hope to put more there later. You know, it doesn't make children or anything, but I have to put it myself.
Nice.
Because we all know interest doesn't really help much with savings accounts. You have to do other things, right?
Right.
But, you know, when it comes down to it, yeah, I wish Bitcoin was better, and I wish that financial institutions didn't sell my information. I wish for many things, but Santa Claus is just not coming forward. So, oh well, I guess we're all screwed.
Well, I'd like to believe that we're not completely and totally hopeless, but I mean, there's that, as far as the reselling of our personal information, I think, are more freely giving for no good reason when we think it's going to be a popular piece of information that we can share with others. So they use a spoonful of sugar, right? I mean, they help us to swallow the bitter pill by giving us something that we think we would prefer, right? It gives us a feel good. So we're happier to trade that information. I heard of a service just the other day. I think it's called, I don't want to give it. I don't want to say its name on the air, but it was a service that would accept, would trade you the access to one of several books for no cost, an electronic book. But that's in exchange for getting your preferences, like a survey. You had to take a survey, and at the end of the survey, you get a free book. And you can each week, I think, you can get yourself another survey and get another book. And I thought that was kind of interesting until I learned that in addition to your information, you only got one book, and some books, they would be $1.99, you know, like $1.99 or something. I just found that to be kind of, I don't know, it's not disingenuous, because they told you up front, hey, you can get one of these five titles, or you can pay a little more and get one of these. But it was, to me, just a little bit too much information that you had to give up in order to get there.
So what kind of questions were these, you know, going back on that? Did you have to say, you know, what was the color, make, and model of your first car? What was the first name of your first dog?
No, these were – that's a good point. These are the specific consumer preferences about reading literature. So it's completely in context. Uh-huh. It's just the fact that you still had to give up personal information, but they basically said, look, we'll exchange you – your information and preferences for free ebook. So, I mean, that's not terrible, but at the same time, that, you know, that's one small example, and who knows what they do with that information. It's obvious they're going to gather as much as they can and resell it. Right. They're going to turn around and make that data mining information available to resellers or to retailers, more likely.
Retailers, distributors, or what have you.
Right. And I just was curious what everyone else thought about that. But I don't mean to just hog the mic here, because I think we should probably, unless other folks have, do you guys have more you'd like to discuss on that, or are you good?
I'm more interested in sticking a finger in a data center.
Well, then.
Okay, fine.
Go for it.
We can stick a finger in a data center. So, as Coop has, you know, alluded to, it was a sysadmin's job recently to stick their finger in a pipe in order to save a data center from a flood. And this comes from theregister.co.uk, where basically, I feel bad. This guy, they call him George. His name actually isn't George, but whatever. You know, he gets a call at, like, 0500 in the morning, and they're like, oh my god, it's leaking in our data center. And of course, as we all know, electronics and water do not get along. So it turned out that they could actually just stick their finger in a hole in the wall. So people had to take turns about sticking their hole in the wall and basically waited till the plumber to fix it. And then it just gets worse. I think this is all of our worst, you know, nightmares for our jobs.
Wow.
This sounds like a really bad children's story waiting to happen.
It does. Later on, they don't say when, but basically, the power supply exploded. And when it did it, it took out the bypass functionality, which resulted in no power and a mysterious odor. They do not go into the odor at all in the article. They just say, you know, chemical explosions just generally aren't good, and you probably don't want to think about the years you're losing as you smell it and wait. So, apparently this electrical issue of this exploded UPS just haunts them for a few more years until the guy finally quits and then he breaks free from the curse.
Oh my gosh. So now that's actually kind of scary, but at least the UPS kicked in, and it just sounds like one catastrophic fail following another.
It does.
It's just terrifying. Coop, have you ever worked in a situation where it was that bad?
Hmm. You know, that bad? It sounds almost like, geez, I don't know if I can tell this story. So according to the chat, I think, Pinky has a really good story. And,
okay. You know,
let's just not protect the innocent or the guilty. Let's go straight to hers.
Nice.
Oh, okay. Thanks. So, if you're at the Saha Talk, like I think 2 months ago, we mentioned our talk. Somebody, CCDC team members and I, talked about how free isn't always free with these cursed Facebook servers.
Hmm.
So, just recently, and we're going to talk about this not in September, but probably October, Saha. So, I'll just give a little bit here. Basically, we just recently moved to a different location that has 220 power because we were having problems with basically the lab that we were currently in. There was only most of the PDU was blown to the point where even to the wall had problems, and the electricians were going to have to rewire it, get a new PDU.
Excuse me, all the that. PDU?
Yes.
Power distribution unit?
Yes.
There we go. Okay, so the PDU was blown all the way to the wall.
Well, the PDU itself was just, you know, basically a fancy looking extension cord, or, you know, power, whatever it's called. Gosh, I can't think. But, you know, you're just general power supply cord at home, just long, and not going there. Basically, just plugged in there, plugged into the wall. Part of the wall, I guess, when they originally did the 220 was messed up. So it wasn't fully outputting as it needed. And then the PDU itself had to be replaced, and it's not all that expensive. Oh, so we moved to a different lab. And there's a PDU there for us to borrow that is not broken.
Okay.
But now that we've moved there, we have one of our ESXi servers just randomly dying on us. So it dies every 5 minutes when you're trying to use it.
Oh my gosh.
It has just recently stabilized. Our FreeNAS was cursed where there was this problem of you can't turn on the iSCSI adapter unless you do a patch. The patch broke and removed the IPv4 functionality.
Oh no.
So then you have to fix that. Then after we got all that working, we closed the cabinet on the rack, and that somehow loosened one of the cords.
What?
So it brought down the whole network.
Oh my gosh. This sounds like the welcome to duct tape, 100-mile-an-hour ducttape.com. Can we help you with your issues? Well, we just need to duct this thing closed. I mean, that's, oh my gosh. Wow. I mean, I think like, I can't imagine, I don't want to imagine how terrible it would be. How do you even, forget worrying about attackers, how do you even keep your systems up and running? Oh my word. Because, I mean, I've experienced, like, I used to work in an industry where usually the device you were operating had to have clean power. And any hiccups in the power line and the computer that operated the giant printer would cause it to reboot. And so you'd be in the middle of, you know, a print worth several $100s, and whoa, that's not good. You have to start over. There's no, you know, it's very difficult to cut, seam, strip, and tape an image like that, right? So it would just suck having to redo your entire image, but if you had the wrong equipment on the same circuit, you can screw stuff up. So folks would always try to put in, like, really, really large UPSs. I mean, like, server rack level or worse. And just the idea that there's somehow a system, like, just running in a lab somewhere that can die because you closed the rack door, that's just silly. It is very strange. Need bigger, better power cords. I think, Coop, you know, you could describe power cords to us, couldn't you?
Yeah, especially after the description of PDUs that we had today, but I think I'll move on.
Oh, okay.
Talk about this AtlasObscura.com article. Yes, this is the first time we've actually had an article from Atlas Obscura, because it's truly obscura.
Wow.
I had to do it.
That's okay.
Blame me later. But anyway, apparently a hacker from South Africa just rescued the first NASA computer in space. Apparently, it's been up there since 1966. Apollo guidance computer paved the way for the moon landing and then sat in a scrap heap for decades.
Wow.
And goes on to give us more about it, that, you know, the navigation control computer launched in 66, Apollo Saturn 202 missions was the first of its kind. Successfully led a rocket out of suborbit, paving the way for the mission to the moon. After that kind of pioneering adventure, you might expect this, you know, metal explorer to be safely, you know, on display in a museum somewhere, but apparently not. it was sitting in the scrap heap and storage in Houston, and this guy, he found it. Apparently identified what it was, and he was like, oh good gosh, I really, it'd be kind of like, you know, one of us walking in going, must fix,
right?
Mm-hmm. And then he also was able to recover the software,
really,
that, you know, was used during the AS-202 launch.
Wow.
As reported, and, you know, it was a unmanned suborbital flight, and yeah, it, That's pretty awesome to find.
Well, I mean, look, I get excited if I find a Raspberry Pi in a junk heap that I can, you know, or some piece of old gear that I can actually revive from its comatose state because it's been sitting in a heap somewhere. But to discover something like this is epic. I mean, uh-huh. So the pictures in the article are cool. They're YouTube video links and everything from the Atlas Obscura article. And they've rescued and they're putting it back on the bench and bringing it back to life. I think that's amazing. I mean, Pinky, are you a fan of older tech like that, or are you just focused on the new, or are you a fan of rebuilding from the ashes?
I have to admit, I'm more of a software person. FreeBSD is much more the hardware person, but I can appreciate all of them. You know, old, new, whatever. They're all, you know, sexy in their own way, and just actually getting able to see something like this in the history. I mean, in some ways, the new technology becomes so complex, so it'd be nice to, you know, play with something like this, you know, what was complex at the time, easy for today's standards, but get to tinker and see the different parts that maintained there versus, you know, what's maintained from then to now and what's died out from a hardware level.
And what about you, Coop? Would you, if you had discovered this, would you be working on building your own, what is it, AGC emulator or board.
I would probably
box?
Contract out that software labor.
Yeah.
But I would definitely play around with the hardware. I'm more of a hardware guy. I would not even attempt to dabble with that ancient code. It'd be like, okay, what retiree can I find today that's in a retirement house or something.
Yeah.
That'll be able to
but it's true. But it's true.
That's so old. I don't know if most of the people that actually worked with it back then are still alive. But yeah, that would definitely be a challenge and fun just to be able to get it up and working, get the right people that are experts on it. It's almost like a scene out of what was it, Space Cowboys?
Yep.
Where they had to get the the aged stuff to go fix ancient technology in orbit. But this would be like finding ancient technology at a flea market, then going, hey, let's fix it. This could have been used to do something like the Skylab.
You need somewhere between the A-Team and Matt Damon.
Why Matt Damon?
Because he always seems to get into these situations where he's stuck on a distant moon trapped in a box somewhere, and he has to grow potatoes from his own poo. Who knows? I mean, if you saw The Martian...
You should know never to rescue him. Because otherwise he's just going to kill your robot and you.
See, well, that's a good point. By the way, loved both of those movies. And this is not Elysium.
Whatever it was, Interstellar?
Loved Interstellar. I thought that was actually a good kind of add-on. Sorry, I will only minorly tangent here and say that I thought that was an interesting extension of the concepts from 2001 about our potential future and how we might resolve the population situation, among other things, in a universe that we find ever expanding and more vast and begin to be curious once again about our place in it. Or maybe we never stopped and it's just pop culture pretends like we didn't care. And that just smaller voices not getting heard over the din of reflective clothing and other events. So,
well, I can appreciate that it didn't feel like I was on drugs, watching Interstellar versus 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Well,
there's a certain part I was like, what happened?
Well, in which? You mean in 2001?
2001.
Oh, yeah. Well, 2001 was an experimental film to me. It crossed the line a couple of times back and forth. And even though Hal asks, will I dream? I thought that right there is that potential that we always question in our minds. Going back to some of the earlier works of Ray Bradbury, where do these stories come from, right? I mean, 2001, these are the people who dreamt so, such big dreams, we could not even begin to capture them until years and years later because it's so hard to interpret. And now we're excited by light switches that we can turn on from across the room using Bluetooth.
We're excited about hacking the things that could turn on the light switch across the room via Bluetooth.
That is fair. That is fair.
Why just do it across the room? Why not, turn the lights off and on in China?
Well, Coop, you know how your lights have been flickering recently? We have something to confess that might or might not have been us.
Whoa. Wait, are you the Chinese? What are you saying?
I don't know how to deny anything.
Wei ni hao. Yes. so, actually, I do find it curious that we could... wait, that's not a negative commentary. Wait a minute. I actually used the proper greeting, as far as I can tell. It's... Oh, well, someone who is a listener who is better at foreign language than I am, please correct me if I said that incorrectly. But the truth is that's in they even mentioned that or joke about it on Big Bang Theory, the TV series. They actually had a thing about, why are you guys so excited about that lamp? And I liked the idea that they were excited because they extended the on-off switch to anyone on the internet. And the fact that someone at random could be messing with your lights. Now, that wouldn't be cool during the podcast because that would, turn off the power and I'd have to fix the microphone. That would suck. That's what I'm saying.
Don't worry, you can just fix it in post.
How dare you, sir? How dare you?
We are so perfect, we don't need editing, Coop.
That's right.
That's a load of shit. We both know it.
The intro and everything.
This podcast is now explicit. I'm sorry if you have children in the room. Get them out quick!
That's it. Before transitioning further to Hacks of the Week, see how I just dove for the connection? We would like to thank our new sponsor, Dangerous Things, who delivers custom gadgetry for the discerning hacker and biohacker. So check them out at dangerousthings.com. And again, if you or your organization is interested in sponsoring the efforts of Saha or Saha Says, please feel free to reach out to us on Twitter at SATXHackers or hashtag SATXHackers. Moving on to the hacks of the week, why don't you take it away to us, Pinky?
So I don't know a better way to start off the hacks of the week other than an article from, again, theregister.co.uk. I might have, you know, a love affair with them this week, apparently, about the most corrupted network ever in existence. So this is a defunct Australian satellite company called NewSat, and they have distinguished themselves in a way that will never be forgotten to the public before the company went under.
Uh-oh.
It got so badly hacked at the most corrupted network the nation's spy agency had encountered.
Oh my gosh. So,
just take that in for a moment. It was so bad that the network, you couldn't save it. There's nothing. They just wiped the slate and had to rebuild the entire thing. And the Australian government had to refuse to hand NewSat a restricted NSA encryption tool for its satellites because it was just in such a bad state that it was like, guys, you know, America or China or whatever is going to get it. So, hell no.
Wow. No, you're never going to get it. Coop, what do you think?
I'm thinking they learned a new definition of the word borked. Oh my god. Can you imagine being a sysadmin there and having to hear that?
You're going to have to leave
like,
the field.
By the way, you're fired because your system is so borked that I've never seen anything worse than this. The cyber herpes are everywhere. And you're never getting it out, so we're just going to take it down to bare metal and then burn it. Kill it with fire.
I mean, kill it with fire indeed. What do you have to do to get so far gone that all of your gear, all of it, like, so when the satellite telephone company, Iridium, had lost their license, they basically went bankrupt, right? So they were originally going to just dive all of the satellites into orbit to burn them from space. Instead, I think it was Motorola came along and said, no, we'll buy it. Or someone did. I don't remember now. But it was, you know, they were actually talking about just burning it from space. This really was that. They literally went ahead and said, well, that's enough of that. We're just going to go ahead and dump the entire network. How do you do that?
So, you know, sadly, I kind of wish this article came back sooner since I think this happened in 2015. But could you imagine if they did a pure, you know, like actual purge, they might have actually sold the hardware. Could you imagine the fun you would get if they didn't bother erasing it before then?
Wow.
I bet you could find it on eBay cheap.
Well, I mean, hey, I've found some crazy things on eBay. You know, if you look for really obscure item, like from a description, if you're looking for certain crypto algorithms and things like that, do these weird kind of long tail searches on eBay and Craigslist. You find folks selling some really oddball objects that are security-related. I'll go with security-related objects. And that's actually kind of the fun part. You're like, oh, cool, what does this do? And sometimes it turns out that, you know, you only have one endpoint. So it turns out that it won't do anything. But in terms like this, I mean, you could probably get some crazy high-end gear for cheap if you felt comfortable running it.
Well, it might be fun to go see what's on it, you know, compare and, you know, set up Wireshark or something.
Yeah, I'm very curious. Okay, this is not going to be a JTAGulator expedition. I think this is going to be something more severe to get it up and running, but you never know. I'm very curious. And, that would be just interesting to see.
It'd definitely be fun to run Ada through that and, you know, start decompiling the shit that's running in the background. Oh, good God.
You know what? Maybe you're right, Pinky. Maybe we do need to set up Wireshark on this. I think that would be fun just to see what it does. So you said FreeBSD likes to mess with hardware. Maybe he's not busy. I don't know. I could be wrong. No. So
see where it calls home.
So that's the thing about actual hardware hacking is that there's always something new to tinker with. And that actually, is why it would be funny, I think, to have to move to our next article that segues into the FBI says that foreign hackers penetrated state election systems. According to Yahoo News, but that's really a very bizarre kind of way to... How can I stop that music from playing? Right.
Hi, everyone,
there. There we go. Hey, good. There we go. Now, The FBI has uncovered evidence that foreign hackers penetrated two state election databases in recent weeks, prompting the Bureau to warn election officials across the country to take new steps to enhance the security of their computer systems, according to federal and state law enforcement officials from the Yahoo.com news article. The FBI warning contains in a flash alert from FBI's cyber division, a copy of which was obtained by Yahoo News, comes amid heightened concerns among U.S. intelligence officials about the possibility of cyber intrusions. Is it some kind of, like, is that a bruise, a computer bruise, a cyber contusion? No, cyber intrusions, potentially by Russian state-sponsored hackers aimed at disrupting the November elections. So, basically, the Homeland Security folks said, no. And they're like, let's go ahead and reach out and make sure that we pay attention to how these election systems are communicating, and let's make sure that there are no credible threats here. So what's really interesting is that it doesn't state that there were any specifics given from the report. But after the call, they did say there were some need-to-know recipients, and it's a title. A warning. The deal is, if we can create enough of a FUD situation, I wonder if there's really actually a concern to be had. Because maybe the method of transmission shouldn't be over the open internet, and I somehow doubt that it would be, right? I mean, it would be very strange to imagine that we don't have offline handling for something as important as elections. Coop, would you, when you have voted, have you noticed the way the, basically, it's offline. It's not all online, right? It doesn't appear to be all wirelessly doing stuff. Or is it all manual where you go to your, when you go to the polls? Cause it's different for each county. So, we may not vote in the same county.
Well, I can definitely say as somebody that works tech support for an election voting machine company, as a temp that, yeah. They aren't connected on, well, at least the ones that I worked on were not connected to the internet, but they were not all that secure. And it makes me very concerned as someone that has worked around that in the past, that, you know, we're heading in that direction. It's definitely not a hanging Chad moment unless you talk about, wanting to hang ourselves by the power cord after, you know, seeing how crappy the security is on those devices.
Well, that's so you fair. Go ahead.
Well, in previous weeks we talked about how some things are unfeasible because, you know, they need physical access and whatnot, you know, like the whole ransomware on the AC unit, you know, you have to convince the user to put an SD card in it. Let's think about this. These computers are, one, probably outdated, probably running Windows XP.
Mm-hmm.
Two, you're in the booth alone. Sometimes you can't be. So if you're in the booth alone with no one watching you, what is from you slipping out from your pocket a USB, pop it in maybe underneath where it's hidden, whatever, small enough USB, I mean, they make them super tiny these days, and go rig the election in your county.
Well, the point that I was making is that when I last saw one of those machines, now I'm sure the machines are different in different places.
I hope so.
The devices don't have a standard USB port on them in an easily accessible way. Now, granted, I wasn't trying to flip the device over. I wasn't trying to, you know, disassemble the kit while I was in there. All I'm saying is that what was there didn't appear to have standard ports, of any kind that I saw. So, I mean, maybe
it has
possible.
To have one.
Sure, but it's gonna it should be a little hidden so that, you know, someone should walk in on you and check to make sure that you're not over there, you know, reading a cheat sheet, so to speak, right? I mean, you're only in there for so long, and you're surrounded by people. It would have to be something you knew ahead of time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
that's why you get a friend. You get a bunch of friends who are hackers, and you each take turns sharing information about what you found on the machine.
See, now you've turned it from an election to just a red teaming
conspiracy.
Situation. Yes, and
the end goal is to get, you know, some ridiculous person winning that county.
So I think it's at this point, it's safe to say that you might have been on this podcast too long in a way, because you didn't seem to used to think like this before, as far as I was officially aware. And you know what? I'm not willing to take responsibility for
you. So in the words of Trump, you're fired? What?
No.
No, we built a bigger wall. That's all.
So I'm just voting for Meatwad in 2016, people. So, anyway,
you're voting for Trump.
I said Meatwad. How is that?
Yeah, that's Trump.
No,
he was on Trump's
haven't you seen the statues?
I have not seen statues. There's statues.
You didn't see? There's the Trump statues. They are horrifying.
They're a small problem.
I was talking about Hunger Team.
Speaking of hanging chads.
I don't know that. Well, hey, look, what you do in your spare time is your business. I have done my level-headed best to keep this podcast a clean podcast, safe for all of America. No, wait, that might have come off a little strange.
Same.
Wait a
minute.
That kind of came off like Trumpish, making America great again.
See, okay, we almost made an entire episode without brand. You realize you're giving that person the most air every time you mention that name. You're giving them more airtime. You realize that, whether you support them or not.
Yeah, but do I feel like our, you know, podcast listeners are going to go out and vote for them? I don't think I'm going to change their opinion.
Well, no, I'm hoping that we basically inform an opinion about security news, not about the election. That's not my goal. So that's for every person to decide for themselves, as Mark Addy said in A Knight's Tale. So, what does this have to do with this article?
Can you save us?
Yeah. I was going to say, this has nothing to do with this article anymore. In fact, why don't we just move to the next story? And, yeah, I'm just concerned. No, the chat room, don't. It's a good thing other people aren't in this chat room, because I would be embarrassed. Meanwhile, instead, let's talk about other things that would be more of a security nature, right, Coop? Maybe some things about Dropbox?
Oh, yeah, you want to talk about Dropbox, do you?
Well,
let's go ahead and talk about Dropbox, then. According to NBCNews.com, Dropbox has been hacked and exposed details for almost 7 million, as in an M, accounts.
70. Does it say 7 or 70?
70.
Does that say 70 million?
There is a zero. I'm sorry. 70.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, I was trying to make it smaller, just like Trump statues, but no, it's 70 million accounts. So that means so many of you, I'm hoping you didn't reuse the password and that you had, you know, at least some two-factor authentication set up. If you don't, do it now, please, for the love of Pete.
Absolutely.
Pete would love that if
Pete,
you actually
Pete
did
would
that.
Really appreciate that. I'm sure you're right. So,
because, you know, the capture's already out there, and some people have already combined it with previously leaked stuff to a big blob that's freely available on the internet now. It's over 50 gigabytes of user data.
Oh.
So that's a hell of a rainbow tables if you ever want to, you know, just see how bad you are at passwords and not setting up your, not configuring properly first and then not protecting it with, you know, two-factor or something, for gosh.
So,
you know, see how bad it is. Because, you know, there were people openly talking about this saying, hey, who wants to host a torrent for this?
Oh, no. So, oh, no.
Yes, it's out
there. So, Coop, what kind of two-factor do you use? What kind do you prefer? Mm-hmm. In other words, do you prefer things like Duo or?
Well, I, you know, not to give all the secrets away, I, you know, anything's better than nothing in my book.
It's a good point.
But definitely, at least see what's out there, what you can use. If you can use, you know, a YubiKey, go for it.
Yeah.
I'm personally waiting for the YubiKey from Dangerous Things. That way, I won't be able to forget it. I won't be able to have it screwed over by, you know, text messaging, spoofing, you know, man in the middle. It will be implanted in my body and encrypted and always able to be upgraded. And we totally went on a tirade of asking questions of Amel from DangerousThings.com last night on my other podcast that I do called Dangerous Minds, asking him all about the YubiKey. So, or not the YubiKey, the YubiKey, sorry. It's similar to the YubiKey. That's why I keep mixing that up. And also, I need more coffee, but we already knew that.
Coffee.
So, all hail the mighty bean. So, So two factor wise, I have to admit I'm a fan of the YubiKey, and I'm a fan of using either the Microsoft or Google authenticators anytime you can have basically a token that allows for a rotating 6-digit code a randomized or changing 6-digit code every 30 seconds that I can associate with that and build up basically a good set of those. And sometimes splitting them off onto separate tokens if possible, but generally set up a good token system. Pinky, what do you find that you prefer?
I would like to eventually become more sophisticated in it, but right now I just use Duo. It's free, it's easy, it's one of the few that UTSA supports for their online systems. I will admit, I just realized I didn't have two-factor on my Dropbox, so while you two were talking, I actually set it up. Duo supports it. Nice. So that took all of 5 seconds while you guys were talking. So those who think it's too much difficulty, that's not an excuse. Duo works. You don't have to type in the, you know, 6-digit PIN other than when you first initialize the account. You just do you get a notification of, hey, someone's trying to log in from this IP. And it tries to, you know, guess the city and states.
Nice.
Is this you? Yes. No. So I think it's a nice little intro step to it. A lot of, you know, places support it so you don't have to worry about the technical difficulties of maybe getting more complex and more hassle on your end.
Well, that's awesome, actually. So that's, and so, you know, Coop, like you were saying from the article, it's a huge pile of data that our folks are going to have out there to use as kind of a selection set that they can basically use as an attack. It makes me concerned and makes me want to definitely... I think as soon as we finish this recording, if our accounts haven't been changed, we're going to make sure we change them. And I hope you don't mind. I keep getting these pings because there's a weather system that I subscribe to. The ringers are off and it still alerts me. I find that amazing.
So should we have a rule then every time you know, somebody's notification goes off that they need to donate $10 to Hackers for Charity? Or EFF, depending on what they choose.
I want to make how much money you make to be donating $10 every time. I'm gonna have to start throwing devices for the door here. Hang on.
Yeah, but I don't have ringers on ever.
But you can see it says off. It's this. Never mind. Oh well. Well, you got me. I kept devices around in case I had to log into things. I had my tokens nearby. And they're on mute. See? It's even on mute. You can see the red... Yeah, never mind.
Audience, can you see the red thing?
You can just see the embarrassment on my face.
Remember, audience, you've heard it here. It takes all of 5 seconds to sign up for two-factor. So be like Pinky.
That's right.
Sign up for two-factor. Even if it means during a podcast when we're talking about the breach. Oops.
Hey, I remembered.
This is good. So...
Do a little word while you're listening to us bitch at each other that our notifications are on and that the other one is too busy setting up two-factor. That means you have all this time to set up two-factor.
That's right. So
I'm editing my other podcast while you're setting up two-factor.
That's great.
Hey, give me a hard time then.
Hey, I'm trying to get this interview edited so I can post it.
Well, that's important.
That's all I'm saying.
Well, I wanted to talk. Would you guys terribly mind then while you're doing this? That see, that's awesome. That's fantastic. Oh, no, that's why. It's actually tied to this device. It's actually tied to the machine I'm running on. I need to turn notifications off. That's
so
why I'm getting hosed.
I'm thinking that, you know, Pinky's going to tell us about some satellite network that got breached.
But wait, I was going to quickly just tell you about making graphene in your own home.
Oh. Sorry, I jumped.
It's okay. I just was going to say that Futurism.com has this cool article about how to make your own graphene. So apparently, if you have water, tape, tweezers, and maybe a microchip and some graphite crystals laying around your house, you can actually make graphene, the material that's one atom thick, stronger than steel, tougher than a diamond, and is considered to be one of the most conductive materials on this earth. You can do this in your own home. So this is actually kind of cool, and they've got a video that describes the process. It's about a minute and a half. It's a video from Harvard, the School of Engineering, the John A. Paulson School of Engineering and Applied Sciences, and they'll actually walk you through the idea of how to do this. So there's that. And whilst that's being watched by our helpful home folk, if there are any, now I'd be happy to say that's just darn cool, because, I mean, it's always neat to be able to make things in your home that won't kill you.
I'm sorry, I have to laugh. I'm thinking about somebody's kitchen at this point. But instead of somebody's kitchen, let's talk about TechCrunch.
All right.
Yeah, a 9-year-old boy was able to print a mechanical hand for his teacher.
Oh, and, that's awesome. This,
he 3D printed it along with his brother. Apparently does a lot of projects with it. And for the article, he did an interview with 3D printing, blah, blah, blah. Sorry. Skipping ahead.
It's all the blah, blah. We love the blah, blah.
Oh, actually,
here.
Yeah. It's a very short article. But you can find it here on TechCrunch. It apparently has a nice YouTube article or YouTube video. Yes, Doug can read. And apparently it's part of a project of enabling the future. Wow, nice pun. Project and can be downloaded and printed by anyone online. And it makes me wonder what kind of filament he used. If he used a nice flexible one so that the hand will last more than 30 seconds. Though, yeah, he is a 9-year-old kid, but still, you hear a lot about charities, what have you, 3D printing hands like this for kids overseas. And, yeah.
It's just cool that you can see someone learning how to, at a young age, develop the skill set. I mean, that's a skill set that's going to obviously be in great demand in the future. And can actually produce a usable, articulated prosthetic. I mean, sure, it's just, maybe it's short-lived now, but it's the idea that you can get started that way. I mean, wouldn't it be amazing to see, your own child, hey, dad, help me with the printer. I need to assemble these items. And what are you doing with this? Well, this plus some zip ties and I've got a working hand for my friend who, who was badly burned or physically injured or whatever the reason was. I mean, it's just really encouraging, I thought. And Coop, mm-hmm. Have you actually, because I know you do go to the cons that talk about all this, like you've described in a previous episode how there was a gentleman who was blind who could see, basically get the impression of colors, mm-hmm. or was it sound? It was sound, wasn't it?
He was able to get the impression of colors through sound, and he actually has a TED Talk about that, basically says it's called I Hear Color, and actually he was one of the keynote speakers at BiohackCon last year, this past January, and that's also where I worked a booth building hands like this. And, maybe Pinky should volunteer and work that booth, because, that way she can be banned from 3D printing, too.
I kind of think that Coop wants to kill me. I mean, the first one we'll talk about is, making your own graphene at home, which... I'd noticed conveniently moved on before we could talk about cooking myself that way. Now we're talking about 3D printers and volunteering myself. So I'll either set the venue on fire, Coop on fire, or myself on fire.
Now, I didn't say that you would be the...
When you build graphene at home, then you'll lose your hand. But if you can 3D print a hand, because you've done this before, you can totally replace that hand that you've burnt off by making graphene.
Can you 3D print the graphene in a way that doesn't cut off your hand? I'm just going to keep.
That is a good question.
That's a good
question for Pinky.
Yeah, well, oh goodness gracious, Pinky, we actually have complete faith in your ability not to end your own life or burn down your home. It's just
I'm glad because I have no faith.
Oh, here I was attempting to redeem.
Faith, you can run out of your home once you've burnt it down, but we're not too sure any of us will actually survive.
Oh my
goodness.
I'll
make sure to take a video and post it. How about that?
Thank you. You're like, wait, I'm having to run down the stairs as they're on fire. But wait, I'm getting video. Let me live cast this.
I need to do a live
this.
Facebook
stop,
feed
drop, and roll.
Yeah, stop, drop, and roll.
Stop, drop, and roll.
Oh, gosh. So for what it's worth, I did find and disable the notifications. So I'm slow, but I catch on. So thank you for enjoying those sounds. And apparently I owe some money to... Hackers for Charity here.
You've heard it here. Hackers for Charity, the check's in the mail.
There you go. And meanwhile, I was wondering if we could actually look into some self-healing clothes, Pinky.
So after I managed to burn down my house and whatnot, I'm obviously going to need some self-healing clothes thanks to, that stop, drop, and rolling.
Wow.
Because as we know, I'm graceful and I'm going to have to, tear up my clothes. Thankfully, DigitalTrends.com is talking about this cool squid protein, about how apparently, I guess the squid ring teeth have this ability to heal themselves.
Oh.
So scientists have been inspired by this and have developed a new bacteria yeast solution that's been shown to repair most fabrics. So what you do is that you take the solution and you place a few drops on the fabric tear, apply warm water, and press the torn edges together for about a minute.
Oh.
From there, you just watch, and you watch them, it magically seam itself back up.
That's
kind of
awesome.
Much better than a Tide pen.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
So
this is exciting, I think.
Well, because, I mean, imagine if you had actual, like, you have a your clothing that gets cut or damaged, and you could actually...
While you're ripping it off?
Well, no. Why was I... What are you... What additional...
Because you were on fire.
Well, there you go.
You had to, you know, rip it off. While, you know, stop dropping and rolling.
Stop dropping. So...
Or when your rack decides to eat, you know, make wounds of some sort. I mean, last week I came out with about 5 different cuts thanks to the rack.
Oh my gosh. Well, no. Hey, network equipment is dangerous. Computer equipment bites. It's true. If you've ever assembled hardware systems, you know that it's very easy to wind up cutting yourself. You're like, how did I even get cut? Where did this come from? And I found, like, especially when I used to build computers as part of my job, you just, oh, look, you're just trying to reseat this board, and then suddenly, bam, blood. You're like, what happened? And it just happens over time. You just don't notice it until suddenly there's blood in the computer. That's awesome.
Have you managed to pull that off?
It usually had something.
I haven't done that yet.
Really?
Keyword.
Yes.
I had done blood on the outside on the case. But I haven't actually gotten it physically inside yet.
Well.
Which is surprising since those servers are open and, you know, only have a little plastic cover protecting them. Yeah, and jacket edges.
I was going to say, yeah, because if you're using the 1U, 2U, depends on the kind of, if you're on a blade system, it depends on what kind of boards you have. It definitely, rebuilding those, I swapped a desktop into one of those very, very narrow rack mounted cases. And wow, it's tough getting equipment plugged in some of those. But that's been a while. I haven't done that in a little while. But we all have our historical jobs that we can probably talk about. So I was wondering if you actually, from a data science or a material science point of view, Coop, if you had clothes like this, because where do you see this being useful? I was curious. I know it's not your story, but I was just curious if you had an opinion on this.
Well, I think it would definitely be handy for, you know, any type of environment where, you know, clothing, protective clothing would be damaged. Like, you know, I don't know, Mission to Mars?
There you go.
Firefighters, soldiers, EMTs, anybody that, you know, works around, even system admins that are working, you know, fighting a flood. You know, clothing's going to get damaged, and it would be nice, instead of a Tide pin to take care of the coffee and jelly from the jelly donut you had the morning on your tie, to be like, oh, I ripped my clothes. Hey, well, guess what? I got the Tide pin for the blood on the computer case, but I also have the squid pin for take care of the holes, too.
Oh, my gosh. I was going to ask. So, I was going to ask if you guys thought this would have a valid use case in, like, the food, you know, in service industry around food and kitchens, where folks, you know, falling knives to the right away, but stuff gets damaged, and that clothing can be very expensive. I mean, this, and what about children's clothing, where, you know, the little kids skin their knee all the time, right? Or they fall, or they're running around outside playing, and they damage their stuff. So why not, with a squid pen, be able to, you know, make quick basic repairs on clothing, extending the life of the clothing?
You know, maybe we don't need to buy clothes anymore. Maybe we just all go to Goodwill, get the cut up ones, and just make our own clothing using the squid pen.
You're going to start popping tags, huh? Well, no, because so I've been to that Goodwill recently, and in looking for shirts, there was this awesome shirt. It was a beautiful high-end garment that unfortunately had what looked like a box cutter cut in it. Like someone had been opening the box, like they just moved to the new apartment, and they cut... had the blade extended too far, cut into the box through the tape, and cut the shirt. And so there it was at Goodwill. I'm like, that's a great shirt, except I'm not going to stitch it together. It just, you know, it's in a very obvious spot on the front of the shirt. But I don't know.
Oh, come on, do it with like some bright neon green yarn. Yes! Come on, if you're gonna stitch it with style.
Oh, hey, I'm with you on that. You know me and my eye-watering colors. I'll do it, because I like those colors. I might actually just have it stitched all the way around so it looks like it's part of the shirt. So you know,
see, this is creativity.
Or just stitch it really small and then you know wear a vest over it.
Well, that too, because I'll wear the vest anyway, because you know vests, especially if it holds lots and lots of stuff. Because I love vests that hold
vests of holding.
Yes, it is. It should be like a +2 vest of holding because it is made of good material, just not Gore-Tex level. Because I would do that. I so totally would do that. But that's neither here nor there. What we should be
do we
talking
need to have
about
an intervention
available at thinkgeek.com.
You're right.
Vest of holding.
A vest of
1995.
Yeah,
but your shipping will be $60.
Yeah, there it is. That's the truth. So I'm going to actually ask us to move on to the App Attic and talk about how Germany and France are declaring war on encryption. So this article that comes to us from the Hacker News talks about how they, both France and Germany are asking the European Union for new laws that would require mobile messaging services to decrypt secure communications on demand, making them available to law enforcement agencies. Because the French and German interior ministers this week said their governments should also be able to access content on encrypted devices in order to fight terrorism. Now, this is originally reported from the Wall Street Journal through the Hacker News, which I find funny. But anyway, the French interior minister went on to say that the encrypted messaging apps like Telegram and WhatsApp constitute a challenge during investigations, making it difficult for law enforcement to conduct surveillance on suspected terrorists. What's interesting about that is, if everybody who has had the opportunity to send encrypted stuff all went and did it, I don't know that we have that much stuff to encrypt to begin with. If it was a fully privacy enhanced world out there, how would we, there is no back door. There's no magic button. I love the movies where they show off a device that can magically decrypt the universe. I just don't see it as a valid, explanation for, well, we just can't trust people. Well, that was the entire point for encrypting the message. What good is having encryption if the whole point is to let someone else just decrypt it without my permission? Pinky, are you, so if you were traveling to one of these countries, would you be willing to consent to having them access your device? And what if they drafted a law that made it necessary that going to those countries would require you to consent to having your device decrypted? How would you even go about doing that?
Well, first, I think this is a really surprising standpoint because, I mean, usually this type of thing we're much more famous in America for happening. You know, Europe you normally go to and it's like, oh, the EU, you know, they're so super privacy. They're always the ones advocating for encryption and the right for it. So it's really surprising to see two of the countries, you know, aiming for this. Maybe Germany not so much, but still a little bit. So, I mean, I personally, it's like, I use encryption because I believe in this, you know, security standpoint. I like Signal preferably.
Sure.
Would I be willing not to use it for traveling? Sure, why not? I personally don't have anything to hide. Do I think it's a little bit of a ridiculous move? Yes, especially when you do law. Also comes down to the point of what happens if, let's say, you bring your normal phone overseas, whatever, you're on your trip, you forget about the silly law, and do you have to decrypt all your previous ones? How do you even do that? That's not even supported in the app. You know, Signal doesn't let you turn off encryption.
Right.
What happens if you're like, I'm not going to use it? Then one friend of yours forgets you're on vacation, you're on Wi-Fi or whatever, it gets sent, bam, you just broke a law. And also, how are you going to actually enforce this law?
Exactly. Coop, how would you enforce this law?
I don't know, but there's some pretty hefty fines and jail term available down in, God, I just had a brain fart. What is the small Arab country? Dubai.
Oh, Dubai. Wow. Really?
Yeah. They have a law in the books. They will, you know, they will slap you silly if you use VPN in their country. And it's only a matter of time until they say any encryption at all because they want that data.
Wow.
They want it.
So that then brings up the standpoint of, you know, technically, you know, HTTPS is, you know, encryption. What happens if you're inside such a Slack that forces you
Sure.
To go to HTTPS. You don't intend to, and bam, you just hit it. You got a fine. Thanks, websites. You know, we're trying to be more secure.
Right.
And now we're having to fight with security versus legality.
That's interesting. So I actually looked up a quick article on this, and yeah, it said that they have made effective... The UAE may have effectively made it illegal for anyone in their country to use a VPN for secure proxy service. And if you're caught, you could face jail time and fines upward of 2 million dirham. Oh my goodness. So that's like between $136,000 and $544,000. That's just amazing. So it's just that something must have happened. I mean, you don't just randomly go around creating edicts like that. So it does make you wonder what the backstory there is. Just very interesting. Let's talk about another concern about sharing data and privacy. Coop, could you take us home, so to speak, on some FBI-owned mega upload?
Sure, I'd be glad to. Though, one more thing on the encryption story.
Yeah.
It might be something we want to reach out to Axion about. They have an exit node in Germany.
Uh-oh.
Oh.
Makes me want to know, what do they think about this new rule, and what are they planning on doing with their exit node?
That's a very good question. We should reach out and see if we can't get an answer, some kind of suggested op-ed piece from them, maybe for next week. I'll see if I can reach out.
All right.
That'd be really useful.
Like you were saying, next article here is from ArsTechnica.com, talking about FBI-owned MegaUpload.org serves up porn and sex ads. So yeah, a MegaUpload domain was seized by the FBI, it's still owned by the FBI and appears to have been hijacked. Apparently, MegaUpload.org used to be where you'd go to access vast amounts of films hosted by Kim.com. Yeah, he actually legally changed his name to that, Mega Upload Service. But once .com was hit with U.S. criminal charges, that site and many others were grabbed by the FBI. Visiting them produced nothing but a government seizure banner.
Wow.
No longer. Now, you visit MegaUpload.org. When, as reported by the article, and not safe for work thing brings up, and what you can only be described as softcore porn. Text ads for casual sex, adult affair dating, adult cam chat, blah, blah, blah. Ad goes on, surrounded by pictures of ladies in their undergarments. So, yeah, needless to say, FBI still owns the domain, but apparently they're not in very good control of it. What do you guys say about that? Does the FBI host the best porn or what?
Well, I think this is unfair that, first off, there are no male, you know, models in the advertisements. That's just, you know, sexist.
Oh, you need some full frontal for it?
Oh, boy.
I do.
So it's more about equality from your point of view at this point. You're really just concerned that there needs to be a fair amount on both sides of the fence.
Yes, if you're going to hack it and make the FBI look embarrassing, let's do a high quality job of it.
Well,
go all the way, not just half to half. So let's, you know, hack them all the way.
And I have to say I don't have to say, but I'm going to say that it's interesting in a story regarding basically Kim.com, who has been sticking his finger in the eye of authoritarian folk for a long time, this is this person's stock and trade, it seems. And that's his MO, right? I mean, Kim.com always likes to have a little limelight and get a little sharing done, I think is the phrase. And Mega Upload, wasn't that like the comeback from the last time that he got in trouble and his site got taken down?
Yep.
Yeah, so he basically, this is his second or third go-round. So it's interesting, and is he in a non-extradition country, I wonder? The article mentions that the proceedings over his extradition from New Zealand have dragged on for years, so apparently he feels pretty secure where he is. In December, a New Zealand judge ruled that the former internet mogul must be sent to face trial in the U.S., but he's appealing it. So I guess they could just drag that on forever. It's interesting how that goes, right? It's how I like to... It's very interesting, just from a story point of view, of how you could just keep poking the bear, and really it's very difficult to get someone to face trial for that.
Well, how about a more interesting standpoint off this? You know, trying to make it a little bit more serious here. So you know the FBI owns this. Do you think they actually bothered protecting it at all? They just don't care? You know, what, is this a, you know, indication of how shitty the FBI is doing from a technology, you know, cybersecurity standpoint? Should we be concerned? Or is this just being like, we own it, we don't give a fuck, we own it, you know, we're just going to stalk all the traffic, do whatever you want. We'll trace you down and maybe try to peg you on something else.
I honestly would imagine that the FBI would quite literally take control of the site, but then if there were external sources that posted through it or to it, they're just going to observe that traffic. I mean, it's in their best interest to keep it up and operational, I would imagine, to allow folks to keep it going. In other words, to allow folks who want to post, let them post, right? Because it just gives them the data, because the seizure notice is published. It's not like it's hidden. So why wouldn't they just keep farming that? Because it says it right on the site, according to the article, that, hey, the seizure notice is visible. That would mean that anyone who's continuing to publish new ads, whether it's on a rotation system or it's a cron job, I highly doubt that they would have gone in and said, okay, let's make sure we block everything and just redirect. But I don't know. I'm not on their team. I don't have visibility to that. Is that how you would handle it, Coop? What would you say? I know I just left turned at you there.
Yeah, when it comes down to this, I'm thinking that what we've read about in the past where the FBI is having a talent shortage due to filling of cups, you might say, that it sounds like they're just doing a really bad job and they just don't care about it because they've got so much else already to do. What are they going to care that much if, you know, people continue to upload porn to that? You know, if they can at least block the downloads, then they can, you know, trace back to everybody that, you know, uploads to it, as long as they didn't, you know, do it through a VPN through, you know, Germany or Dubai or something like that.
Nice.
That just logs it anyway, or does it through Tor, and which just goes through their FBI servers anyway, right?
There's some debate about that. And I actually find it to be kind of strange that as we listen to the concepts of the FBI having concerns about how they manage it, I mean, at least from that point of view, that there are still more security breaches out there. That you can't catch it. This is not like Pokemon. You can't catch them all. Because there's just so much that happens every week. For example, there's that Chinese certificate authority, right, Pinky?
Yeah, so a Chinese certificate authority called WuSign, I think, or WoSign, I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce it, actually gave out the SSL certs for the GitHub domains. So, in previous episodes, we've, you know, have advocated the use of, you know, trying to stop doing self-signed certificates, you know, move to SSL, HTTPS, all that. So apparently, WoSign has given out free or inexpensive domains before, certificates. And in this case, all you had to do was, if you could provide or prove control of the subdomain, they would give you the cert for the overall domain. So as a result, they were able to get GitHub's domains. There was another one that I need to grab real fast, but it was basically, I think, for one of the universities in California.
See, that I actually find that to be kind of terrifying. So they're issuing certs that I wonder how many browsers their root chains are preloaded into, right? So, I mean, who automatically trusts WoSign? Because I don't know how you could do that. Like, how would you prove control?
Oh.
And it's very strange, and I wonder how much they charge for that, by the way. It's a loophole that someone might have found. it could be a huge problem. But this is, well, as you quoted, in June 2015, an applicant found a problem with their free service. So maybe there's something to that. And they actually have some good explanations, you know, infographics that describe the graph. But it's, I don't know, maybe some folks are just messing around. I'm not sure. It's very, very confusing when you get deep into who owns and operates a CA. It's very difficult to prove who owns and operates it. But it's very, very important that if you find a fraudulent certificate, you've got to report it to the respective CA and get it taken care of quickly, because otherwise that can create real confusion in your user base. So yeah, they say the CA system is broken. I say we just need tighter controls and a way to enforce it. But how do you enforce it? It's not an easy task. Very, very curious how that goes. Cooper,
ahead. Their recommendation is certificate transparency, which again, you know, is up to the user to go see. Allow you to monitor how many digital security certs have been issued for their domain, but that puts a lot of, again, burden on the user and domain people. I mean, so is that fair? Is it the responsibility of who owns the domain to do that? So are you going to say Google should do this on a routine basis or what?
I think there should be tools. I think there should be tools that we understand how to use. That, in other words, there have to be accessible tools. That's my opinion on it. I don't know if you guys agree or disagree. I'm going to ask Coop if you think that a tool that made certificate checking easier would be a good thing, or would it still not be enough?
I don't know. You know, to be honest, it doesn't really seem like the certificate authorities actually doing this. It seems, you know, if you want to get all tinfoil hat about it, it's just SSL certs that the Chinese, you know, People's Army picked up during their normal hacks and then released through one of their dummy corporations for fun. Just, snub the nose of American companies and how they, you know, aren't able to block them or, you know, hack back. Just to get a little bit of conspiracy juice on this.
Well, and I have to agree that if that was the case, this is yet another good indicator that we need to move forward and consider certificate pinning and things like it, or maybe even the certificate CA auditing system that allows us to check on whether or not we should trust, or help with whether or not we should trust a cert. Certificate pinning, of course, is the technology that allows you to, when you go and visit a website, you get an updated kind of receipt stapled to your initial connection request, or that's close enough, that basically says if this certificate is valid at this time. Now, that is by no means the whole story, but that's the short version of it. And if you aren't doing certificate pinning, there is the concept of the notary system as well, which was introduced a few years back. The idea that if you were going to go ask, think back to that scene from Desperado, if you haven't seen that film, and there's a scene where a couple of guys are running some drugs and they go inside and say, hey, I gonna make a deal with you. And the guy said, well, wait here and I'll go check out your credentials. Basically calls someone, checks on you and comes back. And, that's how they got validated, is because they went and did a separate check. That actual check is the same way that, in a way, that CAs can be checked to see if a certificate is still valid. Nobody cares about that, however. The reality is that most people are already asleep by me going into that three-sentence explanation. But the point is that this is what we're using to establish trust, people. It may not be the best solution, but it's the one we got, and we need to work on making it work better, unless someone can come up with something better that the world will adopt. For now, this is the structure of things.
I think the bigger problem is going to be, so for example, earlier I misspoke and said it was the University in California, it's University of Central Florida. You know, apparently a year ago, a security researcher trying to get a certificate for med.ucf.edu, but also got the entire domain. So say you find it, you do your proper steps, and you're like, okay, I've reported it to the certificate authority that, hey, I had this one, I shouldn't, sorry, whatever. One, first off, let's go to the typical talk of, let's say you are a security researcher, you accidentally did this because you're, you know, researching it, whatever. Do you get punished, first off, so do you really have an incentive to do it? And number two, just because you report it, I don't know the turnaround time of them actually fixing it and how they do, you know. What's that like?
I hope they at least get new certs issued for both both parties involved or multiple parties involved, because, you know, you got stuff burnt on that one.
And that's a good point. I think that there needs to... So, well, I can talk about PKI and certificates for a long time, but that may not be what you prefer talking about. So I'm instead going to suggest we probably understand that it's a big issue and we need to... It's something that needs to be addressed. And it's bigger than us and we would appreciate your input. Please definitely communicate with us and maybe you've got some suggestions. SATX Hackers, that's where you can find us on Twitter. And instead, I'm going to ask Coop if he can talk to us about some smart weapon designing.
Yes, yes, I can. As soon as I get the right window to come back up. Because unfortunately, I think I borked it.
Uh-oh.
So bear with me and I'll, you know, go ahead and... Because I've actually already read this article, so give me a sec.
Sure.
Because it's a...
While we're waiting on that, just while that's coming up, I will actually mention to you guys that there's some upcoming local cons. Now, there's a Biohack Con coming in January 2017, and that is January 27 of 2017, excuse me. And you can find out more there for visiting the website bodyhackingcon.com. And, of course, B-Sides DFW is coming up on November 5th. And that is available through the Security B-Sides website. And that URL is really long, so I'm going to suggest you search for B-Sides DFW 2016. And you'll find that link through your favorite search engine. Other cons coming up, if you didn't make it out to Hacker Summer Camp, as it's sometimes termed, and you wanted to go to another con that actually holds a bunch of information and is just a little smaller and feels more family-oriented, please check out DerbyCon, which is September 23 to 25, the 23rd and 25th, excuse me, of September, at derbycon.com. That's www.derbycon.com. Now let's get back to Coop and see if we got that article coming up.
Yep. Thank you, Apple, for the fun with a crashing browser. But one thing to keep in mind, you mentioned DerbyCon, tickets go on sale in the spring. Get them quick because they sell out. And then you have to beg and borrow and try and volunteer from your friends to be able to get in. Anyway, the article that we were waiting for was from futurism.com talking about upcoming smart weapons will fire only if you have the right fingerprint. And that's one way to do it. But the neat thing about this particular article is it happens to be a 19-year-old kid that's an undergrad student at MIT. He's developed a smart gun that will fire with just a fingerprint using biometrics that way.
Oh, wow.
And it looks like his proof of concept prototype was built from a 3D printed plastic model and just to show what it could be done. And to go further, it's not a vendor talk or anything, but dangerousthings.com, AML, has done this as well with utilizing, instead of biometrics, which can be defeated, the actual chip that's implanted in his hand has to be scanned into the weapon for it to be able to fire. And that's a fun article as well.
Oh, wow. And so the idea...
Even video on it. I believe Motherboard covered that.
So actually, just some basically an embedded chip in the person has to be in proximity of the device to get it to work?
Yeah. He's got the scanner, looked like from the video, in the... since this is more of a rifle instead of a pistol, like the proof of concept here... It's a rifle, and he's got a sensor in the grip, and because the chip's also in his hand that he would use to hold the grip, you know, it scans there, validates, and then he's able to depress the trigger.
Wow!
But he handed it to the reporter that was there on camera, and the guy wasn't able to do it because he didn't have the right chip in his hand.
That's actually pretty amazing.
It really is
validated.
So it actually validates the chip itself or the identity based or embedded in the chip, embedded in the person.
Uh-huh.
Okay, see, that's pretty amazing. That is definitely, I think, something that we... I think that would be a good idea if we could actually key devices to people. So, I mean, yes, you can still shoot yourself in the foot, but it's got to be the right person. Imagine the safety concept of, you know, okay, so you have a gun safe in your house and a child goes into that safe, goes to pull out a gun, but cannot fire it because they are not they're not equipped. Literally, they're not equipped to fire it. That might be a really interesting thing coming as we go forward. But then again, it doesn't solve everything, but at the same time, it's definitely a step in an interesting direction.
It might also be the right direction, especially if we avoid maybe fingerprints so much, which are a little bit easier to spoof and whatnot, but something actually, you know, like Coop has actually inside you, you know. Yeah. Let's be honest, if someone really wants to cut off your hand, they're going to cut off your hand, guys. So there's only so far we can protect. At least this way, we can't at least just go copy your fingerprint.
That's true. Now, and if I may interject for just one quick moment, Pinky, thank you very much for posting that into our chat feed. The B-Sides DFW conference is currently free. So if you wanted to go sign up for that, if you, again, search for B-Sides DFW space 2016 in your favorite search engine, you should be able to find the link to it that'll actually let you go and connect with all the information that you should need to get going on that. So I wanted to thank you very much and say, Coop, did you have more on this story or more that you wanted to share regarding the Futurism article?
Well, like we were talking about fingerprint scanners being defeated, if you can think back to the 5S, iPhone 5S that mm-hmm. was the first one to have a fingerprint scanner, wasn't a small computer club in Germany that through proof of concept of the attack, Xeroxed the fingerprint retrieved from like a soda can, something like that, and used that to defeat the iPhone's fingerprint sensor.
Really?
Yeah.
So
that was back when the iPhone 5S was brand new, and showed that and then publicized that, and I completely died laughing at that.
Well, yeah.
Because actually, I had a 5 at the time and was like, yeah, I don't really want to upgrade to that now.
Wow.
So it just gives no reason to me.
See, now, they've obviously updated the technology involved.
I hope so.
Because this is basically, they're showing a photograph of a fingerprint was enough for the Touch ID scanner to get fooled. So I'm guessing they must have gone through some grave steps to make this work, because they actually got money for that. They actually, it's an online crowdfunded prize was created, and they actually went ahead and proved there's a possibility. Now, they said that's, what was it? They said, well, they've proved it's possible. There's a big difference between doing it at home willingly and actually lifting a high-res copy of a person's prints. So maybe not quite so easy to do in practical application, but it's definitely possible. So something to keep in mind. At least it was in 2013 when they first brought it out. That's really interesting. Thanks, Goop. Do you have an upgraded version of that device, or did you change platforms, or?
I changed platforms a while ago. So much cheaper and easier just to go with Android.
And does the version that you have currently have a biometric support?
It has a NFC and biometric, but I use NFC for my unlocking.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I can actually unlock it with my implant.
See, that's a very cool way to use that. I mean, I think that's brilliant. Just because that way, even if someone were to grab it at a coffee shop, they can't even unlock it.
Yep.
That's what that's for. That makes the most sense. And then if you want, you can probably flash the other hand up to it and Rickroll someone just with an easy to show demo. So.
Yep. Actually, yes, I can.
So that's,
and you should.
And you should. That's right. So I'm going to actually twist things a little bit and say, you know, each week we get to talking and we get to talking about different things, but we don't really get a chance to really say that if there are any projects we're currently working on, and maybe we should take a second to share and thank some folks that way. So if you've got something you're working on, let's say, Coop, what other projects are you currently working on? Where can folks find out more about what you're up to?
Well, easiest way you can go to it is go to www.dangerousminds.io, because that is my main other project right now, which is just getting this, getting a biohacker podcast started that focuses not only on why in the world would you put things in your body, like just about every news article out there I've seen, and, you know, really kind of when a, you know, writer often enough also gets an implant done, it seems like they get negative about it. So we're trying to put another spin on it by talking to those, talking to the grinders themselves, the guys that are making this stuff, that are, you know, pouring their soul into this, and giving them a chance to talk about it in a safe environment, and also to really just share, you know, their real passion about it, why they're doing it, what they're doing, what have you. And we talked to Emil from DangerousThings.com last night. He's also the sponsor of not just this podcast, but also of Dangerous Minds. And no, we didn't choose the name Dangerous Minds for Dangerous Things. We just thought that it might be fitting because, you know, the minds behind it, behind all these tools, I'll put it as tools, not just classify them as implants or hacks, but tools to upgrade themselves, it, often enough are considered fairly dangerous and labeled as, you know, very negatively, almost insane. And we're just trying to, you know, look further into it for our own education, because the three hosts on it, my two co-hosts are from the UK. They're both, you know, biohackers as well, like me, but we don't actually produce this stuff. We want to learn more about it, and we want to share along while learning. And that's why it's kind of funny last night, you know, our first, as my wife puts it, official recording, because we had done two other recordings before then, but it wasn't as official because it wasn't, you know, truly the what we gathered together to do in the first place. And, you know, reaching out and learning something new, it became very difficult to not just to pay attention to the guy we were interviewing instead of actually working. So once it's actually posted, I'll be actually listening and enjoying it just like everybody else.
Outstanding.
And that's what I'm doing. And for now, what are you guys doing? I know Pinky's all about the CCDC right now due to all the emails and the servers and the cuts and the bruises.
Yeah, as soon as that server decides, our servers decide to stabilize, we're going to try to introduce one or two more servers into it once we get more RAM. And starting this Friday and Saturday, we're actually starting up on our practices full time. We had about 50 people, if not more, show up on Friday. A few people didn't because of San Japan. So it's going to be really interesting to see how this week goes, and hopefully we can keep everyone interested. So I think I'm going to be going insane.
Oh, no. Well, I hope you keep your sanity. And San Japan, for those who aren't tuned in on that, is a local to San Antonio anime / comic con type event, focusing more a little more on cosplay. And it's interesting because it happens almost, you know, on the opposite side of the year than PAX South and other things that happen around here. But it's a good con, and a lot of good folks are out there and have been out there this weekend. Meanwhile, is there anywhere else they can catch up with you, Pinky?
If you stalk UTSA enough, you'll probably find me or on the way home or maybe sleeping in the server room.
Okay.
Oh, room is well, so what about Saha? I heard there's something
well,
happening.
Yes, yeah, I was
every month.
I was actually going there next. So
I know Pinky brings something called Bullet usually.
Yes, well, I will be glad to bring it again.
So, don't forget, Saha's monthly meeting is on the 6th of every month, rain or shine, at the Geekdom Event Center in downtown San Antonio at 6:30 p.m. Come one,
remember,
come all.
It happens to be on Tuesday this month.
Yes.
So, the day after Labor Day, you know, the day you have to go back to work, people.
So, in other words, we need to, like, stop by Taco Bell on the way in, grab one of those big boxes of tacos.
Taco Tuesday?
With the handle. So, yes. It's Taco Tuesday. What? Nice.
Yes, Taco Tuesday.
And come out and see what's going on. Maybe you can share with us. Maybe we'll share with you. All I know for sure is you're going to learn something at Saha. Now, last but not least, hi, I'm Sciatic Nerd. I also run another podcast. It's been kind of dormant lately, but it's called Security Endeavors. It's a kind of an interview program to try and help people who are looking to learn about the information security community. So if you have a chance, please head over there and take a look at that. You can find the podcast Security Endeavors in iTunes and other podcast, what do they call those? Feeds, RSS feeds, and other hosting services. You can search for it. It will pop up. Thank you so much for taking the time to check it out. And that's our show for this week. We want to make sure that we thank you for listening to us as we trample through the tulips that are in these weeds down here. Please feel free to reach out with questions and comments. You're welcome to find us at SATX Hackers. And maybe next week we might actually talk a little more about security. Thanks for joining us.